January 21st, 1954, philosophy 57.
Seven, no, it wasn't, of course, then called American Philosophy in 20. A boy from New York gave a report on Henry Adams. He stood up there, was a 6 foot 6 tall boy, blonde and very healthy looking, and he said, "Gentlemen, this is us, the part of us that has to be buried." And he made quite an impression on the class. That was during the war, 1942, I think. Henry Adams is in all of you, in all of you, much more than you are inclined to admit. It's there in a very primitive form, but it's there. And it is all the negative elements of your time for which you are not in the sense responsible, but which is, may explain to you what original sin is. That is, it has just, is around you. It's everywhere, in the nooks and niches of your veins and of your vocabulary and of the environment and of the wavelengths on which you can speak to other people in your fraternity or at a commencement or wherever it is. And therefore it is so terribly important that you should see this man, because such a report, these two reports are the beginning of your power to master him. If you shun him, if you say that's not for me, I'm an optimist or so, you have not at all really conquered him. He's there. Therefore I want you to understand that in no other case is it so much your own life that is at stake. You can say that Mr. Adams has made an attempt of a Newtonian sociology. A Newtonian sociology would be perhaps a good summing up of what you gave us. I mean, you see. The third person, you see, an inanimate object, and I like very much your explanation of his being driven into this third person to escape the conversation with his wife and the confession that he was, after all, a man who had been loved by a woman. The third person, gentlemen, in all these modern psychologies and sociologies of the naturalistic caliber, is a repression. If you speak of yourself as he, and if you try to speak of mankind as it, as is perfectly possible, modern man tries even to treat of man as what is man. There is now this new book by Mr. Hawking and Blanchard and all the rest, which begins with the chapter, "What is man?" Now, if what man is what, then it is it. This is, still one step further than Henry Adams, he at least said he, you see. But Mr. Hawking already says it, and all psychology says, "What is man?" Anybody who asks, "What is man?" must get as an answer, "He is something." Now, man is neither what nor something. He is, the only thing you really know is that you are somebody to whom somebody has said, is saying all the time, "Thee." You are these. When the Quakers say to thou and thee, they very clearly place man in his right frame of reference. This man, as long as his wife was alive, was to her thee. You may call it you, but this is ambiguous. I only choose thee to make clear that it is not thou. Thee is a very important form of thou, because I become somebody as a child in the cradle because my mother smiles at me. You see, me and thee are clearer for the status of man than I and thou. That's why I have some grudge with the modern fashion of talking of the I and thou. I know nobody can be I and thou, because you are either thee, you see, or me through the other person. That's a very great difference, you see. If I and thou are only two people, then they are still two he's.
or he and she. There's no difference between the undeclensed, the unchanged I and thou. It's really just a projection of what we had formerly with he and she. The radical change is when you see that this man, as long as his wife was alive, in 1885, he said, had somebody who told him, Henry, put on your raincoat, it's going to rain. That is, he is under orders. Gentlemen, where we are loved, we are under orders. And this being under orders keeps a man sane. As soon as you are not under orders in any respect, you are in great danger. That's why a monk takes a vow of obedience, because the monk thereby is aiming at perfection. A man who has no orders to take is, by this very fact, imperfect. That's why the dream of the self-made man is so terrible, because a man who has no orders to take cannot be free. Because how he handles his orders shows his freedom. But if you think that freedom consists in having no orders to fulfill, then you have no meaning. The second thing that follows, gentlemen, if the thee is that first starting point for my health, for my sanity, then the I is the real response. Because somebody gives me orders, I can then turn to the world and say, in the name of this order which I have received to be such and such, I can tell you. The I is always the answer to your calling. When a painter says Pinksy, it is because he knows perfectly well that he has to crush the world by his painting. So he must be very cocksure that he has received this command to be a painter. If you are weak and the painter meets with no success and the public says, you are a fool, we won't buy your pictures, then the weakling who has this real order must, you see, give up painting and become a plumber or a statesman or whatnot, you see, and say like Churchill, painting is only for my pleasure, if they won't buy my pictures, I better become prime minister. But when you are serious, gentlemen, you can resist in your the disapproval of the world outside. You see, I is a force in life which is indifferent, more or less, of course, only in degrees, to the disapproval of the rest of the crowd. Mr. Eisenhower must say I, and he must be indifferent to your pleasure and displeasure, because otherwise he can't be president. But he must have received his order to become president from a source which has nothing to do with your, my approval or disapproval. Now, what I'm driving at, as gentlemen, that man is always in this triangular relation. And that Newtonian sociology, which makes him an inanimate being, is not just reducing men from an I into a he. That would be not the tragedy. But what you are faced with in your own thinking is that you try to consider yourself as being deprived of two relations, not of only of one. You are not only treated impersonally by statistics or questionnaires, but you are also treated without this dangling command over your heads which tells you what to do. This is declared to be religious, not existing. Now, no I, gentlemen, exists without this thee, and the marriage of, and the father and the grandfather especially, express this. When he was on the staff of his father, he had it just naturally, you see, as having to work within a team in London. And no doubt about it, of his loyalty, you see. And Henry Adams' problem is that he outgrew those natural situations of command and obedience, of loyalty, and we all do. Only in his case, they lasted somewhat longer. You already have outgrown them at this moment. Perhaps when you go to the army, you have it again. But your first loyalty. Now, this man was privileged. He had a father and a grandfather and Jefferson to worship. So he, in three layers, he finally got rid of his loyalties. But you must see that Adams is the better American and the better model case of your own life, because his loyalties carried him to his until 1877. Only when he resigned from Harvard and finished his history of the Jeffersonian administration, was he through with his loyalty, you see, with the things that ordered and commanded his respect, his service, his explanation, you see, his application of their life. Of course, all this is only another form of describing you once more the Henry Adams and William James situation. Because I try to show you that William James, as long as he said I, had always the eloquence of the father in front of him, who had made it conducive to him to speak in his own name, but within this frame of reference of a loving father who had preceded him, and whose vocabulary or whose way of speaking he could supersede, but who was still there all the time. We have talked about this at great length, but I want you to furnish you with some vocabulary which is now not taken from the real situation of the James family, but from this modern ideology of the it and the he about men. Henry Adams was, in a way, still less degenerate than you, because you actually think that the question, what is man, can be asked. I've just published an essay in Germany in which I refute this. In the name of the laity, the layman, I say all these experts who ask this question do something senseless, ridiculous. So, would you kindly see these four stages? I, two, three, four. That's the abnormal sequence through which, so to speak, or in which direction our poor Henry Adams traveled. And you all find yourself already in this fourth helpless stage. Anybody who asks about himself, what am I, can never find an answer. Never. So the question has to be dismissed. And as long as you do not dismiss the question, you are a Newtonian sociologist. And Newtonianism is superseded, is ridiculous. To put it from another angle, if you take the fixation of the atoms, everybody will mention his second thermodynamic law, which is entropism. Above this, as you rightly said, is for the living things, evolution. Above this in society is there's degradation. Above this there's crisis, and above this there's catastrophe, the end of the world. Now, I do not agree with you, Reed, that he did not prophesy correctly. This isn't, he did prophesy, I think, correctly. All prophecy says a little more than what happens. But you cannot dismiss the two world wars from not being part of the prophecy. That is the catastrophe of the democratic dogma. After all, we have today absolutism, state absolutism, with the people raging in the State Department on mere suspicion. We have a new form of government. There's no democracy in the United States at this moment. So we have a complete change of all the principles of government, and we have two armed camps, and we have the atomic bomb. And before, we have destruction and complete destruction of Europe, which of course entails the vision of Henry Adams that by 1917 the human mind, you remember, will have to take a jump, because it will no longer be able to deal with reality. It will not understand it any longer. Well, that's exactly what happened when the United States plunged into the World War I. Ever since, the people of the United States have not known what they have been doing. Do you know what we are doing now? Nobody knows it. We're just in the dark. And ever since 1917. Men has lost control. In Europe, they lost control in 1890, is my guess. In America, it happened a little later. We had here a kind of respite. But do you think we are not drifting at this moment? Just wait and see what happens in 3 days in Berlin.
You'll be surprised. Well, look at this. These are five forms of the awkward. Which term is lacking here, gentlemen? Which makes a naturalistic mind, the he mind, the it mind, the inanimate object mind, seemingly scientific? If you look at these entropism, devolution, degradation, crisis, and catastrophe, which very simple experience of humanity is not in it? They are all negative terms.
Salvation.
Salvation.
I speak of negative terms. What happened to Mrs. Adams?
Death.
Yes, she died. Now, you see, in the days before the inanimate dogma, the it dogma of Mr. Adams, people were naive enough to say, I must die. And they tried to build an edifice of creeds and faiths and beliefs around this very simple fact that all men must die. And so the word death appears in all traditions before 1600 at the foremost place. You will see that all modern science tries to evade the term death. Death has become unnecessary. We have the machine age. We shall replace all the appendices and eyes and brains. You see, we have an artificial brain, and Mr. Lindbergh went so far to invent an artificial heart, as you know, and death is unnecessary. And when people can help it, they don't speak of death. That's an appetizer. I mean, a friend of mine, I told you, died in his own house very meaningfully, to the great blessing of his family, and the neighbor said, how indecent not to go to the hospital. Because a decent man is not seen when he dies. It's obscene, you see. That's the point of the, that would be the point of the age of the dynamo, you see. Death is never to be mentioned. So you can see that all the people since Herbert Spencer and Stuart Mill and all these apostles of the Enlightenment for the human society, Mr. Comte and Henry Adams, foremost in his books, have to project the reason why they have to think so hard into terms that omit the cause of their thinking, death. It's all projection. And you know what projection is in psychoanalysis, an inability to face the cause for your mental processes. Modern men cannot fathom why he thinks, as long as he isn't confronted with the simple truth that we think because we have missed out. Awesome, our beloved die. I mean, it is just as urgent that we think because your parents die or your comrade in arms in Korea dies as that you yourself die. I'm even inclined to think that we think our mental operations are feverishly at work more even because other people die, the people whom we love, than that we die. I don't think man's mind is just concentrating on his own survival. He's much more puzzled when somebody he has taken for granted is suddenly eliminated. That's a very hard thing to believe, and that sets you thinking. Any gap in your, in that what you take for granted as your environment makes you thinking. And death is the form in which this, this occurs, that you must think. Without death, we would not think. You see, any boy who wouldn't have fear death in some form would sleep with 10,000 women, would go to all kind of death, because after all, if he do not die, there is no vindication. Why shouldn't we behave very badly like the Olympian gods? And you know, they behave very badly because they couldn't die. Not to die means that you are imperishable. What I have tried to say is, gentlemen,
that this era of from 1600 to today, in which into which you are born more than people in, on other continents because of the history of America. These people from Mr. Descartes onward, and Copernicus and Galilei to today, all live under the superstition that by projecting death into some process in nature, you will escape the nearness of death in your own life. This looks so objective. Entropism is the getting colder of the whole world, where it freezes out and we would, you see, die in the process. But they're indirectly. All this is indirect. Nothing is directly pointing to you. It is all indirect. And this is what the scientific generalization always does. Any generalization, gentlemen, you see, omits the real motive, the ulterior motive, by which we are forced to generalize. And only he is master of his destiny who knows what makes Sammy run, what makes you and me think. And we do think because we must die. If we only would live, we would not think. And since most Americans have removed death from their thinking processes consciously, they make give the impression very often to me that they cannot think. I mean, most American boys and girls, as you know, girls no less than men, and politicians and men in the public eye, I have the impression that they are all like Grover Wade. They cannot think. They think anything that's needed at this moment. They are pragmatic. Today they think that the communists are bad. In 1940 they said the communists were wonderful. So they think every day, but is it thinking? That's reflection, like a mirror. You hold a mirror before them and it will show the picture of the moment. The kaleidoscope is not thinking. The American mind, gentlemen, is not thinking because I think I gave it in the other classes, a great sentence of a man who died 1,000 years ago. He had on his tombstone, "He fluctuates who wants to live forever," in Latin. Very wonderful word. Will you take this down? "He fluctuates who wants to live forever." And to think means to stabilize the truth beyond your fluctuations. And the American mind wants to fluctuate, therefore it has no truth. No truth whatsoever, except for the unimportant things of the inanimate world. I mean, how oil behaves, you know, and how stones behave. That's rather interesting. We would like to know how you behave. And this is impossible with this type thing. Now, take Henry Adams' situation within these. Gentlemen, this would be the farthest future, the catastrophe, which he prophesied for 1922. The crisis would be on hand, the present. The degradation would be the immediate past, so to speak, yesterday, or even today. The devolution would be the from 1600 onward, from America's founding, from the Pilgrim Fathers, and the entropism would be the universal law of all the past. If you put it in terms of Henry Adams' relation to time, allow me to put it strictly this way. To him, all these times before 1600 are his museums. That's the museum past, or antiquity, you can call it. The Virgin is very old, it's ancient, it's gone. You cannot revive it. Put here the word antiquity. As to America's devolution, degradation, this is, if you take the whole thing, this is the tradition, or the history, you can also say this would be the loyalties. This would be your task, and this would be your destiny. Any man, gentlemen, is faced with all these five relations. You hanging in this network. Certain parts of the world are definitely over.
You cannot go back to the tertiary or the, you see, or the, or any geological age before our time. That's antiquity. Wherever you draw the line, you see, you say this is no longer anything, you see, I can do anything about it.
With regard to tradition, it's different. You can do something about tradition. You can keep this tradition of Jeffersonian democracy, you can keep alive. Loyalties to your father, as in London, when he worked at the embassy, you can enact. They are still operating. The task, that's your own. And Henry Adams said, I have nothing to do in this world. He absolved himself after his wife had died from any task. Isn't that true? And destiny, he only described in terms of this entropism.
You see?
Which is certainly the opposite, the negative destiny. The destiny of the earth is to burn up, to freeze up, I should say. Not to burn up by atomic energy, but to freeze up, to die by inanition. So you see there's a great relation between these minuses. This is all minus. Every word here which I have put is plus. Because even a museum is plus, because it is that which has to be respected of the past. The beauty that was Rome, the beauty that was Greece, you see, that is museum, but not indifferent antiquity, you see. Something highly respectable. Here we have five pluses. I think that's quite interesting, gentlemen. You can describe the scientific bluff of the last 100 years as putting everywhere the minus before the, instead of the plus. Only in Henry Adams' case, it's so very purebred, it's so very complete. Most of your, the people you meet are half-baked. They have one minus, the decline of the West. That would be no task for us. It's, you see, Europe is doomed anyway, and we just retire into isolationism or whatever. No task. Let me alone. Or whatever, how you express it. That would be just a minus with regard to the present-day crisis. If you say, for example, you are against universal service, that means that you, not even this minimum of a task for a modern American is given to you. Let's evade the drop. As most Americans at this moment think, let me alone. We have been confused enough for the last 35 years. Degradation, you see it from Mr. Edgar Hoover or from Mr. Hodges, this man called in the State Department who makes the investigations.
Scott McLaurin.
Yes. You see, suspicion makes law. Well, it does. It is a degradation of the democratic dogma. The government is there without the support of the people. And it has to, or I to suspect the people. And suspicion is enough to be fired. That's a new one. It's a degradation of the democratic dogma as it is inevitable, gentlemen. In Cleon, the Tana Cleon after Pericles had produced the very same effect in Athens. The abuses of democracy must always lead to some form of absolutism. And that's what we have all over the world. Wherever you look, it's just inevitable. Abuse leads always to some, you see, other form of government. And we can only hope that it's very mild with us. We are blessed still that we go slowly in this. Yeah, but the degradation of the democratic dogma certainly has done wormed itself into our history, and 70 years after Henry Adams, even the man on the street knows it. At that time, he was the only man who knew it. Now, gentlemen, if you now look at the education of Henry Adams, let me say one thing more. If you see that destiny, task, loyalty, tradition, and antiquity, which we may call respect,
or what we no longer do ourselves, reverence, perhaps is a good, better word to say than respect,
then you see that his great tragedy was of the naturalist, that he in a way tried every one of these directions of action, for action, but I think he never understood, as you and I must understand, gentlemen, that we do in our lives
these five things five different things in time at a different degree of directness, of immediacy, of exposure to God or reality or the devil or whatever you call the open road of real life. When the war is declared and you are sent to Pearl Harbor, that's a catastrophe which is takes over, and your the destiny of America is at stake. Your life disappears as in importance. You have no task of your own. It is the destiny of the nation, and you may believe very well, of mankind, which on December 7th, 1941, was suddenly challenged. I feel this way. And a man who is asked to enter upon an enterprise of these dimensions of undecided openness, where the whole destiny of men may take a turn in a new direction, is dealing with first-hand life. It's a question of life and death, and you can be sure where there is no risk of death, there is not the highest degree of life. That which doesn't cost life, you see, usually is not very important. A martyr is more important than 10,000 books on theology. That's obvious, because one is ink, and the other is blood. And General Booth is 10,000 more, perhaps more important than the people who wrote at this time that Christianity was finished. Since, thanks to the primitive spirit of General Booth, who founded the Salvation Army, there is still another branch of Christianity alive today. And all the people who in 80 or 70 wrote up Christianity as finished, they are just forgotten. They are not very interesting. All this deals with death. Destiny means that we have to decide whether we believe in a cause and are willing to die for it. Now, Henry Adams said, we'll die anyway, therefore nobody must die for anything. His wife, of course, defied him by her suicide. And that is the great tragedy, that he never understood in this perversion, in this distortion, what life is all about. Under Ivan the Terrible in Russia in the 16th century, 17th century. Yes. Ivan is the 16th century, isn't he?
Yes.
16th century. The first journalist of Russia wrote that politics was only serious when heads were at stake. That all other politics are just a game. As they were in American democracy, you see, down to 1917. You get persecution, and you get McCarthy, and you get all these things today because politics begin to become serious. And then they require risk, you see. Before, it's just a game. It makes no difference. It's just a racket. No, rackets are not serious. But politics is very serious. You know, civilian generals in peacetime want to make a career. 3 stars, 4 stars, 5 stars, they want to get these West Pointers. But Clemenceau, Georges Clemenceau, the great Frenchman, said during the First World War, you see, wars are too serious to be left to the generals. You understand? Wars are too serious to be left to the generals, because to the general, that's a civilian career. That is something within his life.
that for Clemenceau it was a risk of his existence, of his reputation, of his after life, and as Churchill now writes in the in his memoirs, that in modern wars the people, leaders, are executed who lose a war. The reason is because we have so competent officers, generals, and since they make it just a lifetime career and not a question of dying on the battlefield, somebody has to pay the penalty for wrong leadership. The generals are not the ones who pay any penalty. They get a pension and a lackey and a car and a staff. This is very serious, gentlemen. We have so much competency, so much expert knowledge in an army, that the real leadership of the army can no longer be in the experts. Never can an expert lead in catastrophe, gentlemen. Catastrophes invite much deeper forces of men. There is always a religious situation in which the man who has faith is the important man, not the man who has an office. What's an office? Take Grant, he has to be, he's swept into office, you see, because all the generals are nobodies. He's a drunkard and he's bankrupt and he's nobody, but he can win battles, as Lincoln said. So give me any man who can win battles. If he has no antecedents of a general, I still make him the commander-in-chief. The commander-in-chief is not just a general with five stars. It's a great mistake. I'm afraid that
you just learned that.
Gentlemen, catastrophe is inherent in our exposure to death. Catastrophe invites us to invest our life into the risky business of dying for the good cause. That is the character of catastrophe, and the destiny of men, gentlemen, will never be found by shallow philosophies or by shallow theologies or by sermons on Sunday. What you consider the destiny of mankind becomes only known by those acts of you where you risk your life. Any young man who jumps into the river to save a drowning child does more to the destiny of the human race than all the nice programs written in ink, you see. That has nothing to do with our destiny. The men may drive, the men may have illusions, he has dreams, you see. But the man who jumps into the river says, what does he say? What's in this act so great? What does he proclaim as the destiny of mankind? Which dogma is prevails in such a moment? Can you tell me? What? Why is a man who saves the danger of his own life, a drowning child, why is he restoring the destiny of the human race into reality? Because he believes in the solidarity of the human race. That is, he defies the idea that man was created single as an individual. He says the opposite is true. We are created incomplete. Nobody can be saved without saving the last other man. That is Christianity. That's all religion, gentlemen. You cannot be saved unless everybody else is saved. That's the difference from the objective point of view of the scientist who says, I describe your life and I describe another man's life, but I know nothing, you see, of your destiny. Well, the destiny of man is very simple, gentlemen. Since we are on this earth, the solidarity of the human race is the whole problem of history, isn't it? What I'm trying to try to show you is the very profound solidarity between the various generations of men. It is very easy to jump into the river and to save a drowning child, or to go into a third story where a blaze and save a baby in the cradle. And that's nothing compared to the difficulty of saving your grandfather from oblivion, because you are inclined to put fire to his memory and to have him drown. And so I told you, William James woke up to the fact that his father could not drown. That Zen man begins when there is solidarity. When you feel solidarity with a Stone Age Indian, then you begin to live as a human being.
58 and 10, as you know, are devoted to this.
Now, let us look into this further, ladies and gentlemen. Tasks would be lifetime appointments. That is, not the whole life from birth to death, but purposive living, which is only one half of life. You see, if you are president or judge or teacher or professor or research man, this is not your whole existence. You have still your private life, you have your friends, you see, you have your offspring. Your vocation, to most people, this looks at the whole of life. It's only one half of life. It's only the waking part of life. You are not this when you sleep. But the men in prison who is to be executed, like these poor boys in Korea, they are there under destiny. That is, their sleep is wrecked, their nerves are ruined, their total existence is involved, which again people still seem to realize at this moment with these poor prisoners. Well, we had some argument on this in this class, I suppose. And I only want to remind you that any prisoner is nearer to the destiny and the catastrophes of the human race than all these smug people who go on the subway to their offices downtown New York. That's why you have to pray for prisoners. They need it. And you cannot be indifferent to their fate, as everybody seems still to be with these Korean prisoners. That is your participation in the face of the human race. You have no religion if you are not deeply more excited over these prisoners and more interested in the investment of $1 billion of General Motors. Because the task is a lifetime task, but it is not your whole existence. It is not in this total sense life, your life and your death. That's why a man in business retires at a certain age and dismisses it, because it isn't he who is this business, you see. It's a part of him. The loyalties, gentlemen, make you into an appendix of something that has lived. You live on. You are lived by loyalties. If you are in your town distinguished, like Senator Taft, if he had stayed in Washington here, I would have just remained an appendix to his father's memories. But he went to Ohio, and that was a very clever move, a very intelligent move, in order to build up once more his own, you see, following in his own loyalty. And I think that's his greatest political act in Taft's life, that he began from scratch again and did not simply live on the loyalties of the people to his father's memory. So loyalties, gentlemen, are once more removed from the challenge of your individual soul, of your own life. They are still very alive, very much alive. Anybody who is junior, anybody who follows in his father's footsteps, don't say that he is not carrying on life, that he is not creating it. He is respecting it, he is continuing it, and that needs to be done. So it is in the sense, however, of challenge, of risk, it is the third degree of vitality. Don't mean that I'm disparaging any of these writers. I'm a museum character by birth. That is, I would love to have to do only with antiquity and antiquarianism. I'm a philologist by nature, so to speak, and I worship old texts and old vases and old pyramids. But I had to learn in my life that there is a very severe order of direct responsibility and indirect. Tradition, gentlemen, when Henry Adams wrote The History of Jeffersonian Democracy, he wrote a very good book. I recommend it to you. It has come out now in an abbreviated edition, condensed.
Rather cheap, is very good reading, very brilliant writer he is, and any other man, a man here at Dartmouth, a professor, would be proud if he had only written this book in his whole life and done nothing else. And that's enough for the ordinary man, this one work of his. So he is, Henry Adams after all is a man of some capacity and some scope. Because that's just the sideline between 1870 and 1877. He is a professor at Harvard, and so he has this professorial book coming to him, you see, as his output. How many volumes?
Nine.
Imagine.
Well, as I said,
nowadays a modern man at Harvard just says, that's all I can do. And then he gets the Nobel Prize for bad literature. So this man, just as a sideline, wrote up his the tradition of America, the Jeffersonian tradition. And finally he went to France and saw the 12th century, fell in love with the museum, and did this. So if you kindly see, this is here London. This is here his history book. This is his Saint-Michel and Chartres. He has, that's the education, and that's the degradation of the democratic dogma. That's his other book. Instead of a vocation, this accusation of his time, which doesn't offer him any task. Negative to his task. I think what is the trouble, gentlemen, with the scientist is something which you can study in Adams. We all live today a monistic life. Anything that happens in any one year seems to be on the same level of historical happening. That is, here in 1954, let's say, you graduate, I write a book, President Eisenhower is moving, giving a message to Congress, war is declared in Berlin, or whatnot, I don't know, and France and England are severing their ties with the United States, and you put this all on the same level. And you say this, all this happened as it does, it really does. And say this is all what happens. And I think all scientific thinking, gentlemen, has no yardstick of evaluation the directness or the indirectness of an event with regard to real life. Now I would suggest, gentlemen, that we live in five rings of immediacy. And that any event that demands death, sacrifice of life, is first-rate action. Then anything that asks personal devotion, that is somebody saying, this is my business, since it is nobody else's business, you see. This taking up of something that nobody else does is already second, that they do it. Then anything third, loyalty is to be carried on, is in the third ring of mediated life. And so on it goes, gentlemen, until we come to the objective description of myself or the Museum of Modern Arts or Ancient Arts or whatnot, where I try to look at myself as an inanimate object. There I live in the world of museums, in the ivory tower of Dartmouth College, or however you describe this attitude of looking at things. Wherever you have this attitude of looking at things, you are in the fifth environment, in the fifth sphere, so to speak, you see. You are outside the realm of risk, obviously. You see, when you look at the world as consisting of things, you have forgotten that you are mortal, you have forgotten that the whole world may come to an end, you have forgotten, you see, all danger and death. You have finally projected all this into a process, you see, that takes care of itself without you having to do anything about it. And that's it, modern man. And that's you.
And since you grave the dignity of your thinking in the perverted order of thinking that you think better when you think in the fifth sphere of indifference and objectivity, and that you think least when you know that the destiny of mankind is at stake, you are counted out. You are degenerates. You are frozen. You are on the side of Henry Adams. That's his tragedy, which he has lived so that you may not live it, that you may reverse the process, that you may not think that in these five circles, the fifth circle is the best, the Einsteinian circle. That is Einsteinian. That is the entropism. That's the law of the universe, or however you call it, the relativity here. Let's put it here. Relativity is the purest expression of this, which makes no difference for a physicist whether he does blow up the universe by the atom bomb. He wants to construe, so he leaves it to us and says, do what you please. I don't know when to use it, when not to use it. I'll give you in a moment again, which I'll give you a little. Oh heavens, my time is up. Would you allow me another 5 minutes? Here you see. No, go ahead. This would be the sphere which you, what you use to call criticism, or free criticism, or free thought. Instead of a personal class, you sit there and say the times are really very decadent and very degenerate. What can you do? Weeping on somebody else's shoulders, you see, and have a cocktail and say it is really too bad. That's what most of us do instead of a task. The task, gentlemen, that's what the contemporaries of General Booth did, you mean. They criticized the downfall of already then of the church, and Booth said, I don't know, these saved people have to be saved. And you mean absolutely right. Then I'll save them 5 minutes before the end. So I prefer always Booth to the critic. Booth and Don Knox. So he has a very good name. This here, you see, you've seen very much an American business tradition. Loyalty kept going. I wish it would do well. Men should follow their fathers in their footsteps if they have any hope that the office or the business can be kept alive. Because there's a little loyalty in this country that I think we need every bit of loyalty and find to some little fire and some little flame. I think you find also quite some feeling about these loyalties. I remember, mind you, of the alumni fund. It's not a laughable thing, it's a remarkable achievement. Then you have traditions. The traditions are not represented by physical bonds of the grandfather, but the Pilgrim Fathers today, and John Edwards and Cotton Mather, the men I have tried to evoke in this course, you see, they are tradition, but the loyalty has to be reattached, isn't this clear? I mean, there is no loyalty to Jonathan Edwards. You have considered him a fool. And Cotton Mather, he's notorious because of the Salem witch trial. Certainly, you see a negative tradition. But you see, he's still within a context of which we have a certain immediate understanding. Although gone through a very critical mirror. And this would be then the revered part of humanity, Jerusalem and Palestine and the so-called sacred places, which nobody thinks to be sacred, but he talks about it. Like our poor Melville going there in the year 58 and finding just death and decadence is there doing and being unable really to see more than a museum. Gentlemen. No, this is all harmless. I made it quiet. You are with me. Fine. Going all off.
So you see, here is the destiny in the center. Here is the car. Here is the loyalty. Here is the control. And outside there is the loyalty. Now, I could have put in place one in ring between physics and history, the biological or medicine, wouldn't change the importance, gentlemen, of this scheme. The scheme means that by modern man thinking, he is quick to think at the most indifferent, the most superfluous, the standard of living. The relativity, the machine, this is all very nice, gentlemen. Everything, all the four others are living. But what you have to solve is to care for these prisoners and to save drowning people. Because otherwise the whole meaning of all the four other rings disappears. Because then you have no religion. Gentlemen, here is the kernel of your own existence and of everybody's existence today. The direction in which we are meant to travel has to be reaffirmed. And this is the center of meaning. The meaning can never come from this periphery. Never can physics give any meaning to your existence.
Sir, would you say that the outside ring is important to us only as the inner rings are successively more important? In other words, we realize that the most important is what you've drawn there is the inner ring, and you can also attach importance to the outer ring too. But if you
put it this way, gentlemen. Every man is at stake here. Some men are delegated to the periphery. Some more men are delegated to the traditions. Still more men to the loyalties. Still more to the courage of the personal task. And all and everybody, child, woman, and man, have to be dedicated to our destiny. This must be universal. But this is a case of for few. I don't have to understand physics. Let Mr. Einstein do that. I don't have to understand chemistry, you see. These are things for specialists. And they are delegations from the core of mankind. They have forgotten this. They think they are making us. They are thinking us. We are delegating them. I allow Mr. Einstein to be a physicist because I'm a gentle, true layman. And you do. The child of man, the child of nature, the God's child, the man who is sure of the solidarity of the human race, he can even keep solidarity with his comrades who threw the bombs on Hiroshima. But if everybody would throw all his bombs on Hiroshima, gentlemen, there would be no mankind, there would be certainly no meaning in our existence. It must remain an exception, isn't that true? Cannot be the rule. Now, who sets the rule? Who says it is an exception? Can the man whom we hire to be the exception, the physicist, can he set the rule for our existence? He cannot. We allow him to think in such general terms about the universe that it doesn't matter whether it happens 600 million before Christ or 600 million after Christ. To give you now a last point, it's not only but a pointer to your understanding of this disease of the Henry Adams and your own mind.
Gentlemen, Henry Adams had 60,000 years going before. When we take 1600, he had 300 years forward
looking. You said 70 is this remaining. But this means that if you begin this second week,
17.
Oh yes, what?
Well, but this comes, you see, if you divide his history, you can really put the incision into 1600. And then 17 is the last part of the 300. From beginning with 1600.
No,
he dated from the 12th century. Oh, no, not the bread. The bread isn't 16 ever. Bread and is the perfection of the 90,000 years.
And that turns around and goes the other way.
Exactly. So all that's only, as you said, 17, but I think it's just a quibbling of words. But whether 17 or 300 would be short in any case. But I think it's only fair for him to give him the 300, you see. You will see that it makes a little difference. I want to point out that Mr. Henry Adams is very, very much wider still than the modern evolutionist, or he has, as you know, 600, in fact he has 1 billion years for the universe. You know, they have the famous formula for the length of the universe, which really is a billion years. Well,
that's the past. And as their future, they have the Third World War, after the Oman. That is, whenever that state then can take tomorrow, it can take in a few years, and they have no future. And they have all the past. Gentlemen, museum thinking, physics thinking, has only the past. It has no relation to the future. You only know the future if the destiny of man is at your heart. Anybody who knows of the solidarity of the human race, by any one act, by feeding a little baby, or by freeing a prisoner, or by loving with a girl, knows more about the future because he incorporates the future. What is the future, gentlemen?
Infinity.
The future is just as long as the past. There's not a word of truth in all these figures about the past. They must appear that long to a man who begins to sit, to think with one-fifth of his brain and his heart and his mind.
I can think that out too, but it doesn't mean no proof to it.
Any man who is free about time, who knows his parents are as much alive as his grandchildren, has absolutely no preference for the future or the past. I have no such preference. What has to come to life, if it's 5,000 years old, it has to come to life today, a Negro plastic or the discipline of a primitive tribe. We need a such discipline. Let's have it, you see? Initiation or dancing or something. What does I do? I care how old it is. No question for my judgment. Because I feel it's part of the destiny of man, which began to be fulfilled then. Let's have it. Let's save it, you see. It has to come to life again. Gentlemen, we learn from Henry Adams that you cannot live as long as the future and the past are not identical twins to you in your decision. Any man who knows anything of catastrophe, of destiny, knows something about those things that have to be lived eternally. If you know the destiny of man, you know that civil rights must exist in any generation. That they cannot be simply dismissed today because of for pragmatic reasons. If you know that there is a destiny at stake, what do you care about communism and capitalism? Man is obviously bigger than any one of the two. That's not important. You are more important. The solidarity of the human race is much more important than any of these side issues of one generation or one century. And the whole course, I hope, I try to build up on the assumption that although you live consciously in opposition to the previous generation and in frustration by the next generation, you only have a full life whenever you are able to deny this distinction. Whenever your father and your son and you yourself live in one center, in a glow of decision, in which there is no such distinction between past and future. That is, has always, in all times, been called the religious attitude. And it has always started with the victory over death. And it has always started with a frank facing the problem of one generation dying and the other coming to life. Death is at the center, you see, of the problem. And that's why anybody who never mentions death is not fit for the kingdom of heaven.